for human rights, Madame Louise Abba, who has been in the country for the last 3-4 days. She wants to share her impressions and her concerns. And being a Saturday, she has to travel today back to Geneva. So without much ado, Madame Louise Abba, here the local journalists, some of them are international correspondents.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. And I'm very grateful that you've taken time on a Saturday to attend this press conference, during which I just want to share very briefly some remarks with you, and then I'd be very happy to answer your questions. This completes my tour of the sub-region where I visited Côte d'Ivoire, Liberia, and now Sierra Leone. And I'm happy to maybe give you some general impressions of my visit with my colleagues in this country. The first thing I'd like to do is to pay tribute to the work of UNAMSIL, and in particular to the people of Sierra Leone, for the immense progress that has been made in the last 6 years or so. I think in the context of this work, it has become apparent that human rights, the respect for human rights, is absolutely fundamental to the consolidation of peace and the establishment of a lasting peace. Lack of equality and marginalization, I think, still need to be addressed in this country in order to transform what is essentially the end of open warfare, to transform that into a real peace and real security. Different mechanisms have been put in place in this country to try to assist in addressing fundamental human rights issues. The TRC and the Special Court are, in fact, it's quite unique to see a country that has had these two mechanisms activated at the same time early on in the establishment of a lasting peace. And these mechanisms are meant to be complementary, and they need to be sustained. The TRC report contains very important recommendations. I hope that this report will be very broadly circulated, possibly as early as next week. And it contains very important recommendations that the government should implement, and in particular, the government should implement these recommendations through the speedy establishment of an independent, representative, and well-supported national, independent National Human Rights Commission. I think that institution can very well take over the legacy of the TRC and ensure a proper follow-up to its recommendations. I believe there's also a very urgent need for judicial reform in this country. We need a strong judiciary because that, in my view, is absolutely essential for the long-term protection of human rights. Now, let me just maybe flesh out a few specific areas of concern that I have as I finish my visit here. The question of gender inequality was raised in virtually all my meetings here. I have to say I'm very impressed by the work that the NGO community is doing in this respect with the support of various United Nations programs. Lots of concerns were expressed to me with respect to the level of domestic violence, but most critically, I must signal that I have a lot of concern about the total absence of recognition by the government that female genital mutilation is a serious violation of human rights. I encourage the government to exercise leadership in ensuring the eradication of that practice, a practice that is incompatible with human dignity and with the rights of women and girls. A second area of concern to me is the situation and the plight of war victims. On that issue, I should stress again that the TRC has made specific recommendations that adequate reparation should be provided to those who are still living with the consequences of the atrocities that were perpetrated during the conflict and that are unable to support themselves and their dependents. And I had the privilege yesterday of visiting a community in Grafton, and it certainly brought home to me with great clarity that once again we need, as a society, we always need to address the needs of the most vulnerable first. I must also reflect on an overall concern that has been conveyed to me very consistently during my visit here regarding the extent to which corruption continues to be pervasive. Corruption contributes to the inequitable distribution of wealth and is a direct obstacle to the enjoyment of social and economic rights by everyone, and is a major obstacle to the fulfillment of the right to development. In my view, leadership entails responsibility and accountability. Now, another issue I want to raise, which is very linked to the question of leadership, accountability, and responsibility, is that when I was in Liberia, I called for the immediate surrender of Charles Taylor to the jurisdiction of the special court here in Freetown. And I want to reiterate this call here today absolutely unequivocally. Whether or not Charles Taylor had violated the terms under which the government of Nigeria agreed to offer him hospitality, the time has come for justice to follow its course. In my view, there could be no real, lasting, and just peace in Sierra Leone without Charles Taylor facing the charges for which he has been properly indicted. And I will continue to reiterate my call to the leaders of this continent to support that vision of a lasting peace through justice and accountability, and in particular, to collectively support and encourage President Obasanjo to ensure that justice is not entirely sacrificed to other political imperatives. And finally, my last comment is I want to stress that my office, the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, intends to continue its presence in Sierra Leone after the winding down of the UN peacekeeping mission. We are currently engaged in discussions about exactly the size of our presence, but I can assure you that we are very committed to continuing the work that has been done here by civil society and by our United Nations partner, and so we intend to continue our presence here. We look forward to continuing to work with all sectors of society, including the media, which has a particular responsibility in a free and democratic society. And also we intend to work, as we have in the past, with representatives of civil society who also bear a responsibility to hold public officials to account. Thank you very much. I'd be very happy to answer your questions.
Now, will you please, when you are given the opportunity, declare your name and the medium or medium you cover. Christo?
Yes, madam. My name is Christo Johnson. I work for Reuters. It appears that from your discussion with the amputees and the war wounded, where they made several complaints and disappointments about the government, it now shows that you have met with the president and you have discussed some of these things, which I think you, this is more the reason you are coming out with some favorable answers. Now, do you discuss also the issue of Charles Taylor with President Kabah, and what was his own reaction? Since yesterday, you told the war wounded that you are urging all African leaders, especially leaders in the region, to hand over Charles Taylor immediately. Now, did you discuss this also with President Kabah, and what was his own reaction?
Well, I'll speak for myself, and I'm sure you'll have opportunities to ask him what his views are. I did discuss the matter with him. As I mentioned to you, I was just coming out of Liberia. I had made public statements there, and I seized the opportunity of my meeting with the president here to raise several of the concerns that I put to you, including the question of the surrender of Charles Taylor. Now, as I said, I prefer to let presidents speak for themselves as to what their reactions were, but he was certainly, I think, very attentive and receptive to my call for, I think, an effort to address all African leaders, or at least regional African leaders, I mentioned to him that I feel that calls to put, so-called, to put pressure on President Obasanjo, in my view, are not targeting, or maybe targeting him unfairly. I think it's important on an issue such as this one for the entire leadership of the region to speak very forcefully in favor of the peace process. And I have to say that the President was attentive to my call, and I'm sure that you will have opportunities to pursue with him whether he's prepared to take any concrete initiative in support of this proposition.
Yeah, my name is David Tambayo, and Media Center. And Madam, even before the distribution of the TRC report, our government has already issued a white paper, which is becoming a greater concern, without having actually a look at what the concerns of people have been in relation to death penalty, the distinction between the Attorney General's office and the Justice Minister's office, and the 1965 Public Order Act, which kind of ties the media. All these things, people hoped that since the TRC had recommended them, that the government would look at them and maybe implement those recommendations. But even before the recommendations are even to be distributed to the people to even continue the discussion, the government has issued a white paper, which is a very serious stand. Now, in your discussion with the authorities, did they give you the impression that they are ready to bend backwards?
Well, first of all, I was handed a copy of the white paper just when I arrived here, and I haven't had time to look at it in great detail. I stressed to the government the fact that the TRC had been a very serious, very credible process here, and that it was incumbent, from my point of view, it's incumbent on the government to implement their recommendations of the TRC. I would certainly encourage, particularly now that I believe we will be in a position to actually distribute. As you know, there was a problem with the printing of copies of the report because they appear to have been some typing errors. And so there's been a delay in the level of coverage and circulation that we would have liked to see. I understand that this will now be available for very broad circulation, and my office is engaged in ensuring the distribution of the report. My colleagues are already working on this. I hope that a broad distribution of the report will encourage a vigorous public debate about whether or not the proposals that are put forward in the white paper presented by the government are adequate as a form of implementation of the recommendations of the TRC. I believe this is a debate that has to take place. For myself, I'm very supportive of what the TRC has to propose. I haven't looked in sufficient details at the, what many have called the inadequacies of the white paper, but I would certainly urge a very strong debate on that question. What I pressed with the Minister of Justice and Attorney General is the need for follow-up, and I suggested to him that the best vehicle for an appropriate follow-up of the TRC recommendation would be the speedy setting up of the Human Rights Commission, so that there's no institutional vacuum, that there's another good, solid human rights institution to continue to press the government. And I stress here, I'm talking about an independent Human Rights Commission, which will hold the government, press the government to implement the recommendations of the TRC. There were also discussions about setting up a committee for the follow-up of the TRC recommendations. I'm not wedded to any particular model, but sometimes I worry about the duplication of institutions and a depletion of scarce resources. So to the extent that the Human Rights Commission could do the follow-up, I think it should be set up as quickly as possible. We have offered to the government all technical assistance and cooperation that they require to set up the commission and to compose it appropriately with a membership that will be credible and representative and professional and trustworthy. And then let's put the TRC follow-up initiatives in the hands of the Commission. That, to me, will ensure that the legacy of the TRC is not totally dissipated.
Thank you very much. My name is Ibrahim Karbo, Managing Editor, New Citizen, President, Sierra Leone Association of Journalists. You mentioned this very important human rights aspect of our nationhood, that is the female genital mutilation, which has been a topic discussed over the years, at least since I became a journalist in this country more than 20 years ago. The problem has always been the absence of the political will, because in this country, you will agree with me if you ask other people that this is a hot potato. Politicians have always shied away from it because it has very, very intense social, political implications. Notwithstanding that some of us believe that something should have been done earlier to address this very important issue. Now, this brings me to the question I intend to ask. What sensitization program should we put in place to be able to educate the populace and those in authority to address this very important issue? Because actually, we need a lot of sensitization to address this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that this issue is often put at the heart of so-called tensions between the universality of human rights and questions of cultural specificity. And I have no difficulty with the general concept that even though human rights are indivisible and universal, I have no difficulty with the fact that they have to be applied and enjoyed in a contextual situation, in a culturally sensitive manner. In fact, social, economic, and cultural rights are also fundamental human rights. So as a starting point, I want to make very clear that I'm not advocating the importing into communities of standards and values that are not part of their cultural and traditional outlook. Having said that, I think there are limits to what cultural practices, cultural, religious, traditional practices can tolerate when these practices go to the very heart of the violation of human dignity and the protection of fundamental rights of equality, of bodily integrity, and the free choice with respect to controlling one's own body. So again, I'm very conscious that different societies have different traditions, for instance, with the degree of parental control and parental guidance, which is appropriate vis-a-vis children. But I think as a universal human rights proposition, we have to assert unequivocally that children are not the property, they're not object and not the property of their parents, and that their rights, and the same is true for women, that the rights of children and the rights of women are inviolable, have to be respected. Now, when we have to address these extremely sensitive issues, I'm of the view that the starting point is a clear and unambiguous political leadership. I don't consider leadership to say, well, we will have consultation. It's important to have consultation, but the consultations, in my view, have to take place within a framework of direction, guidance, and advocacy. Otherwise, frankly, we will be decades before we see any real progress made. And the fact that a question is difficult and controversial, in my view, is not a reason for politicians to shy away from it. That's exactly what they're there for, to articulate with some clarity a vision, and that's what leading is all about. You don't lead from the rear trying to find the wind of public opinion and follow it in any direction, whether it's appropriate or not. So I believe that in order to launch an appropriate campaign to address this issue, which is clearly a violation of human rights, I believe that we need to ask of politicians that they make a strong and public commitment towards taking steps. Now, I understand that the steps may and must involve consultation, education, discussion, and recognition of the scale and magnitude of the problem. But consultations have to be within the framework of political leadership. And as I said, I stress that I find it very ironic that political leadership shies away from difficult issues. You don't need leaders when there's a broad consensus on something. You need leadership precisely when there's a lack of clarity and a dilemma in a society that is trying to evolve and attain universal standards of respect for human rights. So I think the first strategy should be one of calling on the government to take an enlightened, progressive, firm, and clear direction on that issue. And then there will be plenty of support from the international community, and I'm sure from the NGO community, in assisting the government in moving forward, then through, specifically through legislation, in moving forward in that direction.
My name is Clarence Roy McCauley. I write for the Associated Press, AP. During your discussion with President Kabar, did you sense a political will to implement the recommendations in the TRC report?
We're talking here about a broad range of recommendations, and in my meeting with the President, we did not go specifically, for instance, I did not discuss with him the question of the death penalty. I did discuss it with the Attorney General on a subsequent meeting. I met the President at the outset of my visit. We had a very far-ranging discussion on a whole range of issues, but I can't say that we addressed specifically each one of the recommendations of the TRC. He certainly expressed, and again, I don't want to speak for him except in general terms, he expressed to me the sense of the need to address the situation of amputees and war wounded, these war victims, but we didn't go into a lot of details. I certainly formed the impression that there was that either it was already in place or at least that there was a willingness to ensure that they would have proper access to free health care and an appropriate educational infrastructure for their children. I formed that impression. It was put in very general terms. But then when I visited the community in Grafton, I was concerned that they didn't seem to have been a sense in that community that these benefits had been extended to them in real terms. So I don't know where the matter actually stands.
Thank you very much. My name is Isaac Masako. I am a freelance journalist. Thank you for coming, madam. I'd like to ask a question about the criminal justice system in Sierra Leone. I know it is the responsibility of government to ensure justice, really, but is there anything practical that your office can do to help free up our judicial system now? It's choking, almost choking to death. You must have seen in some papers prisoners running away, they've been on remand for 2 or 3 years. Is there anything practical your office can do to help?
Yes. My own background is very much in the field of criminal law, criminal justice, law enforcement. I was a judge for many years in Canada and all levels of court. So quite apart from my current position as the High Commissioner for Human Rights, I have a particular interest in court, in the judiciary, and in the functioning of the criminal justice system. I believe that there's a very serious need in this country for judicial and criminal law reform. I'm very concerned about band-aid solutions. What the system always cries for, the system itself, is always more. More resources, more police officers, more judges, more prisons. I myself have never been satisfied that the a proper and healthy criminal law enforcement system is dependent on the number of prisons you have in the country. In fact, I think you should have probably a very different proportion than what is currently the case here between people on remand awaiting trial, who, let's remember, are the beneficiaries of the presumption of innocence, and people who are incarcerated because they are serving a penalty imposed by them under the law after a fair trial. And I'm very concerned that the proportion is not correct here. Bail laws are in place to ensure that people who are charged with offenses have a chance to remain at large until they are found guilty and properly sentenced to a deprivation of liberty as a form of punishment. Deprivation of liberty prior to trial is not an appropriate form of punishment because guilt has not been determined yet. Prolonged period of incarceration before trial is a violation of human rights. It's a fundamental right under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights to have access to reasonable bail. No one should be denied reasonable bail except for just cause. And just cause, there are basically two just causes. One, the likelihood that the person, if released, will not attend his trial, will flee or escape the jurisdiction, or two, that the person, if released, is likely to commit other serious crimes in the meantime. If a judge is satisfied that there's enough supervision in the community to ensure that the alleged offender will not reoffend while awaiting trial and will attend court for his trial, there are no reasons to have these people in detention. This is only one example of, I think, initiatives that have to be taken that do not require building more prisons. In fact, they may end up requiring fewer prisons and better conditions in the prison. So I mentioned that my office will continue to have a presence in this country even after the termination of the peacekeeping mission. I hope very much that we can remain engaged, that my colleague here, and I'll certainly give directions to that effect, that we can remain very engaged in the criminal justice reform initiative that I understand may be supported also in the donor community, just to make sure that we don't end up creating a bigger system that carries a lot of the deficiencies of the present one. I think this is an opportunity to again put in place very progressive, just, and fair measures of law enforcement rather than just duplicating a system that is very cumbersome, ends up being very costly, and frankly is not particularly just when it's too repressive. So I hope that we'll have lots of opportunities to engage in discussions and promote these kinds of reforms.
Hola, this is Gaik from Radio Democracy. And Madam, first of all, on the issue of corruption, you said that corruption continues to be a direct obstacle to the right to development in Sierra Leone. What do you think, what needs to be done now as a way to tackle the corrupt practices in this country? And then secondly, with the Twitter visit in Sierra Leone, what impact do you think this year's visit has made in the lives of, you know, the vulnerable people that you met and also government officials? Thank you.
Well, let me start maybe with the last part of your question. I'm not pretentious enough to think that spending 2 days in this country on my part will make a big difference in the life of anybody. I hope that I and my colleagues gave some comfort to a lot of the people we visited in civil society, if only by paying our respect to them and showing that we care and that we take their conditions and their grievances seriously. It's a very modest contribution, but I believe from one human being to another, it's already, I think, certainly part of what I want to achieve. What impact my discussions may have had on government officials, well, the future will tell whether I've been persuasive in encouraging them to take some very bold steps. And again, I don't underestimate the difficulty in some cases for government officials to promote policies that they find difficult to endorse. I hope that I've made some progress in trying to persuade them to move in that direction. Now, as to what steps have to be taken to eradicate corruption, you can appreciate that this is it's a very complex and difficult question. What I want to say, though, to me, the starting point, once again, is that you always need two things. You need institutions, but you also need attitudes. You can have the best courts in the world. You can have an anti-corruption task force or mechanism. But the key is to change very fundamental attitudes, particularly about power, about the use of power, about the abuse of power, and about the concept of breach of trust. I believe that there cannot be a serious eradication of corrupt practices if government officials at the highest level consider power as a system of personal reward, which is a completely inappropriate view of the holding of public office in a democracy. Power entails fundamentally a set of responsibilities and should always come with the greatest transparency and the greatest willingness to account publicly for the management of resources and the deployment of government expenses and expenditures. So I think you need first a population that calls on its leaders to express this kind of attitude, that public service is service. It's a question of responsibility and accountability. And as with everything else, I believe it starts at the top. It starts at the very highest levels of government that will show their willingness to be transparent, to be accountable. And you need, I think, a civil society and an international community that will not be tolerant and, in a sense, almost complicit by its silence. We need to speak out. People need to speak out. The international community needs to speak out. Ordinary people in this country, through the media, through NGOs, have to hold governments to account. But leaders must express with absolute clarity that they hold the public trust in confidence, that none of the money that passed through their hands are for their personal benefit. I think if we at least can have these expressions of attitude, this will then permeate the work of institutions like this, I believe it's a task force, this anti-corruption mechanism. It has to be supported by government, it has to be endorsed. In my view, it should be given very strong powers, direct powers of prosecution. We have to have very robust mechanisms to expose it at the highest level so then we could develop a culture, again, of service and integrity. Now, having said that, I have to stress that at very low levels of public service, if the level of pay, of remuneration for work, is so inadequate that it is essentially perceived as a license for self-help, that also has to be addressed. But salaries of high public officials, in my view, are not in that category. They are not of such an abominable low level that could possibly be seen as an invitation or a license to self-help, certainly not to the level of magnitude that corruption at high levels usually entails.
Yes. Madam, I think you touched on one of a very serious issue in Sierra Leone, that is female genital mutilation, which is a widespread something throughout this country. And it doesn't even stop at the level of illiteracy. It applies also even to the most educated woman in Sierra Leone, if you think about it. Now, as a journalist, I know very well there are countries in Africa. There are few countries, I think just two or three, that have banned female genital mutilation. Sierra Leone is a member of such institution internationally, which is fighting to ban this old practice. Now, in most cases when Sierra Leone is invited, Sierra Leone would not take part. And in one occasion, Sierra Leone is fortunate to have a woman as the Minister of Social Welfare, Children and Gender Affairs. I remember a time I met with her, I want to interview her in relationship with this type of practice. She did not comment, said, let's forget about it. Now that you are here and you have met with civil society group, especially those who are on the human rights side, what was your reaction when you discussed with them? I'm talking about human rights groups in Sierra Leone. When you discuss, what was their reaction? When you discuss this, it's a very, very serious issue, Madam Israeli. Right. So when you discuss, what was the reaction of these people with regards to this practice?
Well, I'll say two things. First, I had the privilege of meeting the Minister of Social Services and Gender, and I raised this question directly with her, and I essentially conveyed to her exactly what I'm telling you here, that I believe that it's important that there be initiatives taken to eradicate this practice, which, as I said, is a very serious violation of human rights. I'm hesitant to reflect on what was conveyed to me by civil society, in part because I had a meeting of about an hour with a very large sector of representatives of civil society. This was one issue that was touched upon just very indirectly in terms of gender inequality. It was linked to domestic violence, sexual offenses, and so on. So it would be unfair for me to characterize that as extensive discussion. But in more informal discussions outside that particular meeting, you have to appreciate also that I move in human rights circles. So not surprisingly, what I heard from civil society, I heard from a segment of civil society that is very progressively involved in that issue. What was conveyed to me is that there is a willingness to move away from this kind of practice. But it would be, I think, presumptuous of me to characterize that as the loud outcry of the whole of the population. I didn't meet anybody who ever claimed to be in a position to represent all views. But again, as I said earlier, it seems to me that this is not an area in which one may lead by following opinion polls or consultations. This takes, I think, to address very deeply rooted practices which, as you say, there's every reason to believe are pervasive along all kinds of different segments of society. You need just a very committed and articulated leadership, and that's what I think we need to call for.
Last question.
Thank you. Madam, when the TRC commissioners held a public meeting here trying to put their report together, one thing that came out very clearly was the death penalty. And some people who testified actually referred to political executions as causative factors for the war. And in their report, the TRC actually did recommend that the death penalty be abolished in this country. But if you read the white paper, it would appear that government has not accepted this suggestion and has not taken it on board. A good number of people in this country still hold the view that as part of a modern society, the death penalty should not be part and parcel of our judicial system because it has the potential to create anarchy in this country like it did. So what would be your reaction? The TRC is suggesting that the death penalty be removed, and yet the government is not totally accepting such a suggestion. What's your reaction?
Well, once again, I share entirely the views and the recommendations expressed by the TRC, and I will continue to urge and press the government to move exactly in that direction. I think this is a movement that we need to promote worldwide. I think it's certainly the trend and the tendency. More and more countries, I think, are moving either to a moratorium on the application of the death penalty and then eventually to its total abolition as a matter of law. Frankly, a moratorium is sometimes a transitional way of demonstrating to the population that there are no catastrophic consequences to abolishing the death penalty, and then it may permit a transition towards its total abolition in all circumstances. Frankly, I think it would be a particularly important initiative in this country because it's a statement by the government, by society as a whole, that it repudiates violence in all its forms, that it repudiates the recourse to a violent form of repression in all circumstances, and it's an affirmation of the value and respect for human life. And if there is anywhere a society that needs to continue to reaffirm its fundamental respect for the value and the sanctity of human rights. I think it's very much here. So I think a step by the government to abolishing the death penalty would send an extremely, a remarkably courageous, positive signal of a change, again, a fundamental change in the hearts and minds of people here, that they are committed at all levels, including at official levels, to affirm their fundamental respect for the dignity and the sanctity of human life. So it would be a very important step. To rely on the debate about the deterrent effect of the death penalty, this has gone on in every society of the world, and there's never been any demonstrable evidence that the existence of the death penalty is a serious deterrent to the kind of criminal conduct that it tries to address. And finally, in any society where there are dangers of weaknesses in the criminal justice system, ranging from catastrophic weaknesses such as corruption to equally damaging weaknesses such as lack of capacity, lack of professionalism, and so on, the chances of executing an innocent, it seems to me, is an outcome that no decent society could ever tolerate. I have to tell you that even for those who are not persuaded on moral grounds, on pragmatic grounds, the likelihood that even the best judicial system in the world has produced judicial errors and innocent people have been convicted, even in systems that have all kinds of safeguards. So if only for that reason, I think that we should continue to press the government to accept the recommendations of the TRC. It comes at a very important time in the history of this country, and I think we should promote the abolition.
Madam Louise Abba, thank you very much. You've been very explicit. It's been good education for many of us. I now recognize the President of the Journalist Association to propose a vote of thanks.
Thank you, sir. Madam Louise Abra, this again, your visit here to this country is one more step undertaken by the UN system, indeed the international community, to stand by us as a country addressing the security issues of this country. Coming to you particularly, matters relating to human rights are matters that are also very, very important, very pivotal in the promotion of the rule of law. And therefore, we appreciate your presence here. This country has gone through difficult times. We have seen bad governance. We have seen the promotion of corruption with impunity. We have seen the execution of people just because they held political views that were different from those who were in power. We have seen all these difficulties. And therefore, your appearance here, your strict vigilance to further encourage us to promote the concept of human rights is a most opportune time. May I also state here that we, the members of the media in this country, have always been encouraged by UNAMSIL to participate in activities relating to the return of peace in this country. We have been very, very satisfied over the years the part, the role played by UNAMSIL. Because after all, if Sierra Leone did not stop fighting, if we did not stop punching at each other or shooting at each other, we would not be seated here today discussing human rights. Again, we pay tribute to UNAMSIL. But again, like all other organizations or the heads of organizations who have visited this country, you have come out very, very clearly explaining to us that you do understand our problems and that your organization is prepared to help us address all these issues. Because after all, we need to address these issues if Sierra Leone must become a wholesome country. Once more, if Sierra Leone should forge ahead to become part of the international community and to become part of the civilized world. Indeed, I must state here that the speed with which we attained peace after the arrival of UNAMSIL is a clear indication that Sierra Leoneans themselves have always wanted this peace. What we needed was a direction, and we did get a direction. Again, like you have come here, we have asked questions time and again, but you've given us the answer. Good leadership can always create all the difference. So once more, on behalf of my colleagues, may I say thank you for talking to us this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Another one that we need it, yeah. You need it, I need it.